all of these bills seem to suffer from, a number of the submissions have made this point, hasty drafting, and drafting that is bad drafting because it overreaches.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. The government's legislation to curb foreign interference in Australian politics has become highly controversial, with media organisations and other critics warning that journalists could be jailed and academic debate would be curbed by some of its more draconian provisions. There's also criticism of the move to ban foreign donations, not for the general thrust, but because one aspect of it is designed to inhibit the left-wing group GetUp and other organisations involved in activist politics. Labor is fighting aspects of these pieces of legislation, and we were joined by Mark Dreyfus, Shadow Attorney General, to examine the details. This interview was recorded on Wednesday afternoon. It should be noted that overnight on Wednesday, Attorney General Christian Porter announced some proposed changes to the legislation, including more protections for journalists. But no doubt the controversy about many aspects will continue. Mark Dreyfus, do you acknowledge that there is in fact an increasing problem of foreign interference in Australia, especially from the Chinese?
Labor does acknowledge that there's been an increase in espionage activity. That's something about which evidence has been given by ASIO before the Intelligence Committee, which is currently holding hearings into the Espionage and Foreign Interference Bill and also the Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme Bill, which is part of the package that the government introduced on the 7th of December, an hour after marriage equality became law in Australia. The Labor Party certainly accepts that there's a need to do more in relation to espionage, to modernise our espionage laws, which is in part what this package does, and that there is a problem about transparency of foreign influence in Australian politics. But the question is not whether we accept there's a problem, but rather what to do about it.
Now, obviously the media have been very vocal in their criticisms of aspects of this legislation. Journalists would be partially protected by a defence in the legislation, but nevertheless, people have said, organisations have said, this is very insufficient. What change do you think is needed in that regard?
The problem with the defence is that it's much too narrow, and the government, I think, has now conceded that there will need to be changes to it. It's too narrow because it only protects journalists after they've published a story, and it's too narrow because it requires not only that you be a journalist and have published a story, but that what you have done be what's called fair and accurate reporting. That's a term that I am surprised to even see in proposed legislation in the Australian Parliament, because it's inherently something that is incapable of being given a clear meaning. I'd invite you to consider whether, say, President Trump would ever agree with the editor of the New York Times about what fair and accurate reporting was, and the idea that you need to establish that in a court of law as part of your defence, it seems to me to be very problematic.
So you just scrap that, or how do you fix this?
Well, the government seems prepared to offer a defence for what you could call ordinary journalistic practices that have been part of journalists' work in Australia for many decades. We have to work out a way for that to be defined. And as well, the government needs to consider that it has, in the proposed new secrecy offences, included a whole range of conduct that is part of ordinary journalist work. What they've done is make criminal receiving a document, for example. Not only would the journalist have committed an offence merely to receive it, but the editor, the journalist's editor, on looking at the document would be committing an offence, and the journalist's lawyer, on giving advice about the document, would be committing an offence.
Even out of stray filing cabinets?
Even out of stray filing cabinets. And a point's been made by some of the criticisms that the committee's now received and have been pretty well publicised, that possibly the person who bought the filing cabinet at the Fishwick store might have committed an offence, certainly as soon as he opened that filing cabinet.
Now, what about the academics' criticism? They're worried that this will jeopardise collaboration with other research institutions.
The academic criticism was of the other bill, the Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme Bill, And the Group of Eight and Universities Australia appeared before the Intelligence Committee last Tuesday and gave very, very direct evidence of the huge administrative burden that the government's bill, if it becomes law, would impose on them, making the point that universities are engaged in a huge range of collaborative international activity. And the way the government's bill is presently drafted, if any of that research activity leads to lobbying of government, one can readily think in the medical area of how research work produces a new drug that leads to lobbying for that drug to be included in the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, or for the Department of Health to fund in some way the introduction of whatever medical advance is discovered. That's lobbying, and the universities are very concerned that they are caught by the scheme when the government doesn't actually intend that all of their research programs be caught.
So this needs to be amended in some
way. Yeah, it's again, all of these bills seem to suffer from, a number of the submissions have made this point, hasty drafting, and drafting that is bad drafting because it overreaches. So in the case of the universities, their proposition is that there needs to be a much narrower, I took them to be accepting that there should be some kind of transparency in relation to foreign influence in Australian government politics, but what they were saying is that the way that the bill has been drafted, it catches almost all of their research activities.
Is Labor in favour of the proposed register of agents for foreign influence?
Well, that is the Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme. It would require registration by any body that has what the legislation calls a foreign principal. That's, again, a very incredibly broadly drafted concept where anyone that's in collaboration with something called a foreign principal, which can include not just a foreign government, not just a foreign company, but any foreign individual, as in a non-citizen and non-resident of Australia, all of those together can be a foreign principal. If you collaborate in any way, then you are required to register. It's not just the universities that are complaining. The charities of Australia are also complaining, saying that it will interfere with their activities if they are required to register, as this scheme seems to imagine they should.
So do you favour a register, but are you saying the provisions need to be rejigged rather than not being in favour of a register?
I think that the provisions in the bill as currently drawn cast much too wide a net. That's the point that's been repeatedly made to the Intelligence Committee by those organisations in Australia that in the short time that the government has provided for submissions have managed to make a submission. And I might say on that note, Michelle, that the Intelligence Committee has now extended the time for its report. It was to have been the 20th of February, which was much too short a time. It's now been extended to the 23rd of March, and the time for submissions has reopened. Anyone that's interested in this, in either of these bills, the Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme Bill or the Espionage and Foreign Interference Bill, can make a submission up to the 16th of February.
I think that was an ad.
It was an ad, and as well, the Intelligence Committee is going to be holding further public hearings.
Now, the package does go to arrangements for ex-ministers working for foreign interests. What provisions do you think are appropriate in that area? And particularly, are you comfortable with, for example, Andrew Robb, former trade minister, going to work for a Chinese company immediately after leaving Parliament?
I'm not comfortable with that. And I think most Australians looking on would find it somewhat shocking to think that a federal cabinet minister who has been directly engaged in trade negotiations with China, directly engaged in negotiations that brought about the purchase of the port of Darwin by this company, a Chinese enterprise, should end up working for that very same Chinese enterprise within days of leaving Parliament. $880,000 a year in his contract for doing nothing. That's an extraordinary thing. The Prime Minister at the press conference about this legislation confirmed that Andrew Robb would in fact be required to register. That's a good thing. But what's perhaps more concerning is that under the Turnbull government's ministerial code of conduct, there's nothing wrong, apparently, and the Prime Minister has said this, and Andrew Robb has said this, in him going to work for this company within days of leaving Parliament. I have a problem with that.
So do you think there should be a longer cooling off period, as it were, or do you think there should be a ban on
I think there should be a ban. And if you look at comparable countries like Canada, countries like the United States, countries like Britain, ex-ministers cannot go and work particularly Canada, has got an actual legislated prohibition on ministers going and working for quite a long time, as I recall, in the areas of their portfolio.
Now, the government has signalled that it will make some changes to the legislation. Do you feel that a deal can be struck in the end about this package?
Labor's got a history of working in the Intelligence Committee, of working on national security legislation in as consensus and bipartisan a fashion as possible. Labor shares the government's objective of keeping Australians safe, of making sure that our national security laws are optimal and designed to keep Australians safe at the same time as achieving a balance with our long-established rights and liberties. I think the government shares those objectives. I think we've shown since August 2014, when the Abbott government introduced the first of what has ended up being some six bills in the national security area, the Intelligence Committee, which consists of six Liberal and National Party senators and members and five Labor members and senators, has made more than 100 consensus recommendations, all of which the government has accepted. So I think we can point to that record over the last 3 years and say it shows that certainly the government is capable of working with Labor. I was heartened to hear the new Attorney General, Christian Porter, say that it was inevitable that there would be changes to this package of legislation. Senator Cormann, who's responsible for the fourth of the bills in this package, the foreign donations bill, has said pretty much the same thing. He's accepted that changes will need to be made. What I've called for is for the government to explain what changes it is prepared to make so we know what we are talking about. But if it means that the Intelligence Committee has to make a whole set of recommendations for change, we'll do it that way.
Just on foreign donations, Labor's in favour of a ban
yes.
on foreign political donations, but it's very critical of the plan as put forward by the government because it seems to target GetUp and would also catch some other activist organisations. But where exactly, conceptually, do you draw the line here? Is it a matter of exempting certain groups, or is it a matter of the monetary amount? Or,
well, we've said for many years now that there should be a ban on foreign donations to political parties. We've also said for many years now that the threshold for disclosure of all donations should be much lower, at $1,000 rather than the $13,500, which is where, because it's indexed, the threshold presently sits after Howard increased it to $10,000 and it's crept up year on year. That's an absurdly high amount for disclosure of political donations, and it is used, that high threshold is used now to conceal many, many donations that political parties receive. So not only should there be a much lower threshold, there should be a ban on foreign donations. We've said that. What the problem is with this legislation, and it's one that's created the odd alliance of not only GetUp, a progressive political organisation, but the Institute of Public Affairs, on any view, a right-wing political organisation, which is complaining just as loudly as GetUp at the way this legislation has been drafted. As with the other bills in this package, the government has cast the net too wide. It's a broadly drawn bill.
But how do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I don't think, for example, that we should institute a system by legislation that requires people donating more than $250 a year to sign a statutory declaration, which is one of the components of this foreign donations bill, as some kind of verification process, it seems. The government wants to legislate to make everybody donating more than $250 a year, which is pretty low. Extraordinary that they don't want to lower the threshold for donations disclosure from the current $13,500, but they do want to make everybody making a donation over $250 a year sign a statutory declaration. It creates a terrible burden for any organisation that's receiving donations.
So little foreign donations should
yes.
be okay?
No, it's all donations that would require this statutory declaration process, not just foreign donations. I say again, Labor favours a ban on foreign donations to political parties, but whether or not there should be a ban on foreign donations to charities and other participants in the Australian political process is a different question.
Okay, so and you'd be looking at where the foreign donations were coming.
That's right. We'd be looking at where foreign donations are coming from. The government should think about what can be done simply. What can be done simply is a ban on foreign donations to political parties. And then you might consider if there is a desire to reduce or eliminate foreign influence in the Australian political system, whether or not you can in fact at any practical level legislate in the way the government's done, which is at present would prevent very many charities who quite legitimately are engaged in advocacy, and it's been long established by High Court decisions that it's a perfectly proper part of charitable activity to advocate for changes of government policy. This government seems to think otherwise. And I met with, in Parliament House this week, as did it with Andrew Lee, our spokesman on these matters, on charitable matters, I met with a group of more than 40 charities, all of whom were expressing concern about the chilling effect that this donations law, if it comes in, would have on their activities. Organisations like the Pew Foundation, which has played a very useful role in advocating for changes of environmental policy in Australia, but is in fact a foreign-based organisation. It operates in Australia, but it is of course funded by a whole lot of foreign sources. The Fred Hollows Foundation were there. They too receive quite a lot of their funding from overseas, but they too need to engage in advocacy to change government policy. And the government, I'm sure, does not intend that there will be an elimination of advocacy by these organisations, and nor, I'm sure, does the government intend that there would be a huge administrative burden placed on these organisations. So there needs to be a rethink. The government needs to think, how can we practically achieve the objective, which Labor shares, of reducing foreign influence in our politics. But what needs to happen here is that we can't proceed with the current broadly drafted bill.
Now, just what should be the situation in relation to Australian residents who make a donation that is likely to fall into the category of foreign influence? They're Australians or Australian permanent residents.
Well, they're not caught because that's not going to be a foreign donation.
But shouldn't they be? Because some of the controversial donations we've heard about in recent times have fallen into that category.
Well, that's the question. And as we understand it, it's what the government intended in introducing at the same time. It's said by the government to be a package, this foreign influence transparency scheme, which would require people who were acting on behalf of a foreign principal or collaborating, which includes this notion of a very broad notion, a notion of collaborating with a foreign principal. If someone's in that situation, they'll have to register, and that's something that's a broader concept than just receiving money or giving money to someone to operate in the Australian political system. It's a difficult problem, Michelle. We accept that it's a difficult problem, but why shouldn't the government start with something that's pretty clear and ban the receipt of foreign donations by political parties?
Now, on another issue, despite the hype before Parliament resumed on Monday, the government has so far not referred any more MPs to the High Court over the citizenship issues. Are you still confident that all your MPs, the Labor MPs, have complied?
I think that most Australians are heartily sick of this citizenship wrangle, which has gone on and on and on since last July. Labor has said repeatedly that our MPs have taken the reasonable steps that the High Court in repeated decisions has said is required in order to be eligible to run for the Australian Parliament. Our concern is that it took the government months to accept our suggestion that there should be a disclosure scheme where MPs put on the public record their citizenship status, and if there was reason to think that they might be a citizen of another country as well as Australia, they explain why they're not. Regrettably, a number of the government MPs have chosen to use this to conceal their situation rather than to disclose it. And that's why on the last sitting day of 2017, we put up a motion with the support of the crossbench, which would have seen 9 members of the House of Representatives referred to the High Court. The government rejected that. It didn't want at that point to refer the Labor members. It didn't want to refer Rebecca Sharkey, and it didn't want to refer the 4 of its own members about whom there is doubt. Now, the government has continued to threaten to unilaterally, in breach of a long-standing convention that this shouldn't be done unilaterally, they've threatened to unilaterally refer 3 Labor members to the High Court. We don't know whether the government intends to proceed with that, but we would say If that is to happen, then there must be referral of all MPs about whom there is doubt. Chief among them would be Jason Falinski.
Looking beyond the present imbroglio over this, and assuming that people get their citizenship fixed up before the election, Section 44, which covers dual citizenship and also conflicts of pecuniary interests and offices of profit under the Crown, that section is now going to continue to cause problems into the future if it's not fixed up. Would you support a referendum on this? I know they're difficult to get through, but nevertheless, as you say, people are sick of this. They'd probably vote for such a change.
I think before we do that, knowing just how hard referendums are to get up in Australia, we haven't had a successful referendum in Australia since 1977, despite a number of attempts since then, not least among them the Republic. And I think there's other things we can do first, such as political parties paying much closer attention, candidates paying much closer attention to their eligibility. There's things that the AEC, the Australian Electoral Commission, might be required to do to make sure that candidates have paid attention to this. It has become apparent, I know I sound partisan, that the Liberal Party, unlike my party, seems to have had no internal processes for properly vetting and properly checking the citizenship status of their candidates. The National Party in the same position. And certainly, you're right, Michelle, to say that before the next election, every candidate, you would hope, is going to pay a much, much closer attention to their citizenship status. And so too with the other provisions. I don't think that the Office of Profit under the Crown provision is so difficult to comply with. I don't think that the provision in Section 44, which says you are not eligible if you have a contract with the Commonwealth, is so difficult to comply with. It simply means ordering your affairs in such a way that you make sure that you're not holding some other office when you go to stand for Parliament and that you don't have a contract with the Commonwealth.
So you say let the current section stand and fix it up by the Ministry of Matters and more diligence?
I think there's other matters that I'd want to take to a referendum before I took this one to a referendum, and I want to have a long, hard look at whether we can, in a sense, reduce the risk, make sure that the problem that the Parliament has had since last July is not to be repeated ever again. And I think we could probably go a long way, and I've been very much thinking hard about this as to what changes might be able to be made that the Australian Electoral Commission could assist with before we go to the trouble of having a referendum.
Can I ask you finally about the new Home Affairs portfolio? That's now brought under one umbrella, the border security function, and also ASIO and the Federal Police, although those remain independent. Many people have criticised this for too great an aggregation of power. Would a Labor government change those administrative arrangements or leave them intact?
We've noted the concerns that have been expressed about this aggregation of a whole range of law enforcement and intelligence agencies under one minister in the hands of one person, which is always a concern in liberal democracies. You've got to be concerned about concentration of power. We've noted that none of the agencies have, not ASIO, not the Australian Federal Police, and no other agency called for this change to occur. It wasn't mentioned in the review of the Australian Intelligence Community conducted by Michael L'Estrange and Stephen Merchant last year. And we'll look closely at how the implementation of this goes. It's obviously a prerogative of any government to reorganise where agencies sit and to reorganise ministerial responsibilities. But the concern I've already expressed publicly is any change carries with it risk of disruption, that in fact we might be being made less secure by this. Certainly contestability will be lessened by putting all of the agencies in one place under one minister. We'll see how it goes. It was striking that when the Prime Minister introduced, as part of this package of four bills, a very small bill that deals with some changes of ministerial responsibility for the Home Affairs Department to be set up. Most of it was done by administrative order, but there's this bill. He very much stated that there was not a thing wrong with the current state of our intelligence agencies and the Australian Federal Police and generally our setup for national security. He claimed, and this has been the Prime Minister's claim, that we've got to have an eye to something possibly going wrong at some point in the future, and that's what this administrative change is directed at. we'll be monitoring very closely. There's one thing I would mention, because it came up today in a hearing held by the Intelligence Committee, and that was the extraordinary situation of the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, not a very prominent agency in Australian political life, because she does most of her work in the shadows. The Inspector General has to do most of her work in secret. She is the agency set up after the Second Hope Royal Commission in 1986 to ensure that there is oversight and an integrity mechanism for our intelligence agencies. To see the Inspector General sitting there today saying that she did not support an additional power being given to the Attorney General, who is one of the ministers whose activities she looks at, to direct her in inquiries, it's a pretty extraordinary event. I hope that the Intelligence Committee will listen to what she's had to say. What she had to say was it's sufficient for the Prime Minister to have that power of direction, and she didn't think that it was appropriate, indeed potentially creating at least the appearance of a conflict, she didn't think it was appropriate to give that same power of direction to another minister. That's a very serious thing when the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security raises a complaint about a bill that's before the Parliament. Certainly I'll be taking her concerns seriously, and I hope other members of the Intelligence Committee will do the same.
Mark Dreyfus, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.